Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have Adam Rutherford with a history of everyone.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure. It's quite an honour to be invited to a history festival, and for me, as a non-historian, to be the first speaker at it. I'm not a historian at all. And I feel like I have to be very explicit about that. I'm a scientist. I'm a geneticist, more specifically. I present the Radio 4 programme Inside Science, which is where you might have heard me, or probably didn't identify me, but it's just one of those voices on Radio 4. But in my real life, I'm a geneticist. And the reason I'm here and the reason I've written this book with a slightly ambitious title is that a strange thing happened to geneticists in the last few years as a result of the Human Genome Project 17 years ago, which was that geneticists effectively became historians. By default, unwittingly, we became historians for two reasons, really. One is that we became very adept at reading DNA and understanding what DNA means and how it can be translated into living organisms, living people. But also we got very good at extracting DNA from people and organisms that have been dead for thousands, tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of years. So the combination of those two things meant that we suddenly had this new information source, a new text, historical text, that we could use alongside the more traditional ways of knowing the past. And I want to stress that DNA does in no way supersede other more traditional forms of knowing history, but sits very nicely alongside existing tools that we have for looking at history. So that is why people like me then became interested in history. And I think there are some really good examples of how genetics has integrated into history and has helped us retell or revise or confirm stories from history, stories that we know very well through traditional history, but have been informed or changed or reinterpreted using DNA as our evidence source. Now, one thing that DNA does that other historical sources don't do is that it is a historical source which we all contain, right? It is universal in human beings. So this is a text which is not written by victors or by kings, but is contained within us all. That phrase that the past is a foreign country, the phrase that I use in the introduction is the past may be a foreign country, but it turns out that the map was inside us all the time. So having said that DNA is a great leveler as a historical source because we all contain it, it is effectively just an archive, a sort of logbook of every successful sexual encounter that all of your ancestors have ever had. And that's not right, is it? That's not right. It is a log of every reproductive sexual encounter that... Those two things are different, so sorry about that. But it is simply a log of all of your ancestors who have passed on their DNA down the generations to you and this unique map that you all contain. But having said all that, part of the book concerns stories that are defined by royalty. And there's a specific reason for that, which is royalty are the people that we know the most about from history. And so if we can inform those stories with new evidence using DNA, then it enriches our understanding of history using DNA. Now, so what I'm going to do in this talk is talk about the first half of the book, two chapters in particular, which concern four kings. In fact, actually, in the book, there's only three kings, but one of them has emerged as an important part of this story since the book was published last September. So those four kings start with Charles II of Spain. Now, many of you will know about Charles II of Spain, and particularly the family from which he comes, which is the Spanish Habsburgs. Charles was the last ruling member of the Habsburg dynasty. He died at the age of 38, just before his 39th birthday, in 1700. But for the previous 200 years, the Habsburgs had been the dominant family in the largest chunk of Europe. So during that time, they had provided all five of the Holy Roman Emperors and ruled this enormous swathe of land that went right down to the Iberian Peninsula. Charles was located in Madrid, but he lived an extremely troubled life. He was profoundly disabled and mentally disabled as well. He didn't learn to walk until he was about six. He didn't learn to talk until he was about seven. Now, for that reason, his courtiers gave him the rather unkind moniker, Carlos el Hechizado, which means the bewitched or the hexed. Now, when we learn about the Habsburgs at school, the one thing that everyone remembers about the Habsburgs is that they had a very prominent jaw or bottom lip, known as the Habsburg lip or the Habsburg jaw. In modern medical parlance, we call it a prognathous jaw, but it was this characteristic forward-jutting jaw that you can see on many members of the Habsburg dynasty. So this is Charles II in the top left. This is his father, Philip IV of Spain. I honestly don't know what's going on with this gentleman here. I think there's enough distance between us and the Habsburgs to laugh at that. This gentleman is his aunt, but you can see very clearly that they've all got this very prominent prognathous jaw and forward-jutting lip. Now, we laugh at it now because it looks kind of ugly and kind of clumsy, but in fact, this was considered a badge of divinity for this family. They wanted to pass this characteristic down through the generations as a mark of being a Habsburg, as a divine right, as a symbolizer of their divine right. Now, one of the reasons that Charles had such a bewitched life was precisely because of that desire to hang on to power and to pass this characteristic through the generations. This is Charles's family tree. Now, if any of you are aware of how normal family trees look, an individual, us, all of us in this room, will have about 256 people in our family tree going 8 generations back. Now, it's probably a little bit less than that due to necessary inbreeding. And I'm from Suffolk, so I can say that with absolute impunity. But if you count up the number of people on Charles II's family tree, there are 29. All right, so it's almost 10 times fewer than a normally outbred person. And so if we just go follow the pathway through some of these, some of the tree. So Charles II there, his father was Philip IV, married to Mariana of Austria, and was the Philip IV's father was Philip III of Spain, right? He was married to Margarita of Austria. Now, you could also go a different route via his mother, Mariana of Austria, via Maria Anna of Spain, to Margarita of Austria. Now, if you follow that, what that means is that Margarita of Austria is simultaneously Charles's grandmother and great-grandmother at exactly the same time. Now, this is not desirable. I mean, this is not a characteristic that you would want in a family. In fact, family trees should never have loops in them like this, or like this, or like this, or like this. I mean, this family tree is only made up of loops. And it all starts with the pairing of Philip the Handsome of Castile and Joanna of Castile. Now, Joanna of Castile, she also had a nickname. How's your Spanish? Her nickname was Joanna La Loca, which means the mad or the insane. Now, posthumous diagnosis is quite a tricky thing to do, but she had a suite of mental health conditions which are probably too complex to really analyze, but she was not a well woman during most of her life. And yet this whole family tree starts with Joan of Castile. And so if we can trace the route back from Charles via Philip IV, via Philip III, via Philip II, up to Philip I, that is one route to get from Joanna and Philip I to Charles II. But also on this, you could take a sideline here via Maximilian II, the Holy Roman Emperor, or via the maternal line, you can go Maria Anna, Ferdinand III, Maria Anna, Renata of Lorraine, and or you could go in this route here. In fact, there are 9 different pathways that go from Joanna of Castile and Philip I to Charles II. And what that means is that Joanna is occupying 9 different positions, nine different positions on a family tree that actually spreads over 3 generations, right? So there should be 9 different women in 3 generations when in fact there is only one. And as I said, this is not a great idea for families to remain healthy. This, as you know, is called inbreeding. And in fact, the Habsburg family stopped outbreeding about 150 years before Charles was conceived. Now, again, this is not good news. The reason inbreeding is not great for you is because of diseases which are referred to as recessive. You've probably all heard of recessive diseases, things like cystic fibrosis, where if you have one copy of a cystic fibrosis gene and a healthy copy of the same gene, then you don't have cystic fibrosis, but you are a carrier. If you have two copies of the disease gene for cystic fibrosis, then you will have cystic fibrosis, or any of the other many recessive genes that exist. So outbreeding is a means of introducing new genetic information into your family tree to reduce the likelihood of the expression of recessive diseases. Now, if they stopped introducing new genetic material into this family tree approximately 150 years before Charles II was born, that means that so many of his genes were actually the same from both parents at the same time. And we have a metric for this in science, in genetics, which is called the inbreeding coefficient. So the inbreeding coefficient is a measure of how many genes you have that are the same from both mother and father. And I give you the most extreme example is that if a brother and a sister are successfully have a child together, then their inbreeding coefficient is 0.254. Sorry, it's not. It's 0.25. So it's a quarter. A quarter of all of their genes are identical to each other, which is massively increases the likelihood of that child being unhealthy with recessive diseases. 2012, the calculation was made on the inbreeding coefficient of Charles II, and that was 0.254. So he was more inbred than the child of a brother and sister pairing. Now, of course, he died childless. He was married twice. One of his wives described him as impotent. Another described him as being sterile. And he didn't leave any children or sons or heirs. And he amazingly lived to the age of 39, but it was really... He was rex in absentia, is the phrase that we use. But when he died, there was no one to inherit the Habsburg Empire, and what followed was the Spanish War of Succession. And so what undid the Habsburgs' quest for power, to retain the reins of power, was a 17th century understanding of inbreeding and genetics. And it's this type of interaction between genetics and history that I'm really interested in, what permeates the book. Inbreeding, by the way, is one of the main ways that we understand any genetics. And so we used inbreeding in, do you remember Mendel's famous experiments with his peas? He crosses 29,000 peas in the mid-19th century in order to understand the basic rules of genetics, the rules of inheritance. Those are inbreeding experiments. We understand about genes and chromosomes from experiments on inbreeding on fruit flies in the 1920s. We understand about most diseases due to their emergence in families that are consanguinous or inbred at least first cousin pairings. And so as a geneticist, one is enormously in debt to inbreeding as a mechanism of understanding how characteristics are passed from generation to generation. Inbreeding is great for geneticists. It's not so good for royal families. I'm going to skip over that. Right, anyway, so... Family trees is what this is all about, and I've gone from a very specific and rather screwed up family tree in the Habsburgs to what I think is the most important family tree of all time. This is Charles Darwin's sketch, the first visualization of the tree of life that he made in his notebooks in 1837. And it was on this that he was beginning to think about the idea that one species over generational time would diverge into two via the mechanism of natural selection. Okay, so what I think is the most important idea that anyone ever had. This is 1837, so it's a good 22 years before he publishes The Origin of Species in 1859. But the idea behind this thought remains true to this day. This is the latest version of the Tree of Life. This was published last year, 2016. I like the similarity in the fact that the design is quite similar, but the scale is immeasurably different. There's a lot of interesting things on this. I got a whole lecture on just this one slide, but I'll just skip over it quite quickly. The first thing to notice is that almost all life on Earth is bacteria, has been since the origin of life, around about 3.9 billion years ago. So almost everything that's ever existed, almost everything that exists currently that is living, more cells on you than you have human cells are bacteria. So the dominant form of life on Earth is bacteria, and we should pay some respect to those. Then you have another similar single-celled organism called archaea, which are down here. These were only discovered in the 1980s, but they're also single cell. They look like bacteria. They're very different from bacteria, but they occupy the second biggest group of organisms on Earth. And then there's what's known as the eukaryotes, which began to emerge about 2.4 billion years ago. And that's everything else that isn't in these first two categories. So that includes, I don't know, mushrooms and lettuce and us and blue whales and aardvarks. I'm trying to do A to Z. Aardvarks and zebras. There you go. And we are somewhere around here. Now, this is an earlier version of the Tree of Life, styled in a slightly different way, but I think a very beautiful way. And this is a graphic available online that you can zoom into at any, and the resolution stays the same. What you probably can only just make out on this circle, so you've got the origin of life there, and every time it splits, that's one species becoming two over evolutionary time. But on the edge of this big circle here, you can sort of see like hair-like structures. Well, what they are is, if you zoom in, those are individual named species. There's about 2,000 on this chart, which is known as the Hillis plot. 2,000 on this chart. Science has described about 2 million species so far. We think that there's probably between 10 and 20 million species. And we also know that about 97% of all species that have ever existed are already extinct. So this is beautiful and shows the great diversity of life on Earth, but it's only a tiny, tiny, minuscule proportion of life, of all life that has ever existed. And if you just look up in the top corner where it says animals, and we zoom in there, that's where we are. So again, you know, evolutionary biology really, really likes to put humans in their place on the grand scheme of things. But anyway, the point of showing this slide is that I just want you to look at the way that this area is drawn here, the way that the family tree of life on Earth that leads to us is drawn in this particular way. And this is very reminiscent of how we draw family trees normally. So this is a standardized genetic family tree that you will all recognize. So that's you at the bottom, two parents, four grandparents, eight great-grandparents, and so up through time. Now, this is a standardized version because humans are very messy. We are messy creatures, and nothing is simple. And if history has taught us anything, it is that humans rarely behave in a way which is predictable, as we would like you to in science. So that looks like that's a standardized family tree. But my second king, one who will be very familiar to all of you, this is his family tree, which, as you can see, is a long way from the one I've just shown. And this is, of course, the story of Richard III. Now, you'll know all of this. You'll know much of this already because I know people involved in the Richard III project have spoken at Chalk Valley before. And it's an amazing and brilliant story, but I think it's such a brilliant story that it's worth telling over and over again about how this is the best example of how genetics interacts with traditional forms of history in terms of understanding the past. So there's Richard III. We know lots about him. Actually, we don't really know lots about him. This is the nearest a contemporary portrait, which was painted decades after his death. We know that he died in 1485 at the Battle of Bosworth, and we don't know that much about what happened. There's only really one decent contemporary account of the end of that battle by Jean Molinet, and there are several things within that story that are worth noting and just grabbing hold of for reference to what happened, well, 400, 500 years later in a car park in Leicester. Some of the things that Jean Molinet says are that he was off his horse at the time of his death. He wasn't wearing a helmet as he was bludgeoned around the back of the head. He was stripped naked and slung over the back of a horse or a donkey and paraded around Leicester for the crowds to jeer at before being thrown into an unmarked grave just outside the boundary wall of the Greyfriars Monastery in Leicester. We don't know much more than that. There is a receipt for an alabaster monument from Henry Tudor, Henry VII by this stage. The date of that is 10 years after the Battle of Bosworth. The tomb no longer exists, but we still have the receipt, bizarrely. So, you know, always keep your receipts, because you never know when they'll be useful 500 years later. But then the Reformation happened, and The dissolution of the monasteries and Greyfriars was not exempt from that, and the masonry was sold. We also have the receipt for the masonry, but not the masonry itself. And that's sort of where the story peters out for Richard III for several hundred years. The area in Leicester is still known as Greyfriars, but the monastery itself is lost to history. Of course, you'll know that the Ricardians is a society, a very active society, that's been running through the 20th century to try and reassess Richard's legacy and his reputation, but also to find him. Because of his being buried in an unmarked grave, he's one of the only kings in early modern history that we didn't know where he was. So the Ricardians had been pursuing Richard for decades through the 20th century and into the 21st century, and by 2012, they thought they'd got the location approximately, you know, within a few hundred meters of where they thought Greyfriars might be. And they got there by using traditional forms of knowing the past. So archaeology, some new scientific techniques that work with archaeology, but maps and things like that, written records. And what it led them to, of course, was this car park, which is the social services car park in Leicester. So that's the social services building there, and that's the car park. Now, have any of you been on an archaeological dig before? Yeah, well, at a festival like this, you'd imagine that quite a few of you had. Normally, when I say this kind of stuff at a at a science festival, most people say no, but a few of you have. So my experience of being on archaeological digs, of which I've been on three proper ones, is that you spend about, 6 weeks in a dusty riverbed or a cave, knee-deep in mud, and after about, you know, with a tiny toothpick and a toothbrush. And after about 6 weeks of that, if you're really lucky, you'll find a piece of pottery from the 1970s. Is that your experience too, people who've been on digs? Yeah, or maybe 1980s if you're really lucky. Anyway, the point is that when they began digging in 2012, they found this grave on day one. Right, so they broke ground in the morning and uncovered this grave on the very first day. It says one on it. Right, that's because it was the first thing that they found. Now, this is going to get a little bit gory now, so if you're faint of heart, then perhaps, well, just grin and bear it. This is the bit that the school children love when I do this in front of kids, because it's the only bit they remember, is because it's got lots of head wounds in it. Anyway, so they uncovered this grave, and this is immediately of profound interest to any Ricardian, any archaeologist, for a number of reasons. First thing, I just want to get this out of the way, it didn't have feet. We don't think that's relevant. We think after 500 years of being in the ground, the feet had just been lobbed off at some point along the route. So forget about the feet. The first thing you notice is that this body is naked. So there's no evidence of clothes, a funeral shroud. There is nothing. There is no coffin. There is no coffin plate. Right. So there's no evidence of anything other than this man being thrown in the ground naked. Right. That's one. The second thing is look at the head position. So this is a grave that was clearly dug not for this man. It's clearly too small. So his head is cocked forward in an uncomfortable way. So this grave that the it's not unreasonable to presume that this grave was not dug for this person. The second, third thing, I suppose, the position of the hands are of great interest. It looks as though they were manacled or tied to one hip. There's no evidence of manacles, or there's no residue of string or twine or metal manacles, but nevertheless, that position is quite deliberate. All right. So immediately, you've got a lot of strong contenders for this being Richard. The man is naked. This grave wasn't dug for him. It's just outside the Greyfriars boundary, and the position of his hands is of great interest. So the next thing that you do is you need to seek permission from the crown to exhume anybody, whether it's royalty or not. And the body is taken out of the ground and cleaned up, and this is the cleaned up version. Now, you don't have to be an orthopedic surgeon to spot what's not exactly square on with this skeleton. Have you all seen it? Right. Well, the shape of his spine, this is man, the shape of this man's spine is classic scoliosis, very pronounced scoliosis. So scoliosis is a deformation of the back which is either inherited or can be acquired during life, where if I stand straight on, then one's spine is S-shaped. So it curves in an S like that. Scoliosis is when it curves in an S shape or sometimes a C shape when you look square on as well. Now, Shakespeare, which is one of the main sort of cultural sources of Richard III, describes this man, Richard III, as being a crookback, having a hunchback. You know, now is the winter of our discontent and all that, and having a withered arm. This is not a hunchback. People with scoliosis do not have a hunchback, but when it's that pronounced, it does mean that one shoulder is significantly higher than the other, probably by about 4 inches in this case. So this is a man whose natural posture was like this. It's not a hunch, but he would stood like this. There's no evidence in this body of a withered arm at all. We think Shakespeare made that bit up. So, you know, at this stage, it's becoming less and less likely that this body is not Richard III. Everything so far fits into the profile of the man described by Jean Molinet. Right, this is when it's going to get really gory, so brace yourselves. So this is his skull from the front. Looks okay, looks about as good as a skull can be once it's been in the ground for 500 years. From the back, from the bottom, it's a slightly different story. So this here is this is called the foramen magnum, which just means big hole in Latin. That's where your spine connects up with your skull case. This hole here is not. That is a wound. That is a really serious head wound. So we can tell from the forensic anthropology that this was what we refer to as perimortem, so it occurred round death. We can't tell whether it was the cause of death, but there's no wound healing. There's no evidence that following this injury that this man did anything other than die. Okay, we think it was created by the upwards stroke of a large flat-bladed instrument, probably a halberd. So a halberd being a big spear with an axe head or a big axe with a spearhead on it. So probably an upward blow like that to the back of the head. And if you feel the back of your own head, this is called the occipital lobe here. This bit of the skull is one of the thickest bits of the skull. So imagine the force with which you'd slice off that amount of skull and brain in one stroke like that. That would be fairly instantaneously fatal. But that's not all, because there's also that wound just above the foramen magnum there. Now, that's a penetrating wound, probably from the spear tip of a halberd. So again, another such force on the other side. So again, feel the back of your head there and feel how thick that bone is. The bone just on the inside is called the petrus, and it's called the petrus from the Latin word meaning rock, because it is the thickest bit of bone in the head. So again, imagine the force with which you'd have to thrust through to penetrate that bit of your bone. And in fact, on the inside of the skull case, in a diagonal manner, there is a scratch, meaning that this halberd was thrust with such force that it went through the skull and the entirety of the brain before scratching the inside of the skull. So no one's passed out. Well, we might pass out from the heat in this room. But yeah, that's also perimortem, no wound healing associated with that. But that also would have been a fairly instantaneously fatal blow. Oh, I'll do one more just for kicks. So this is his hip. So your iliac crest is here. This is a hip wound, which is on the inside of the bone. Can you see that jagged edge there? This would be caused by a sharp, possibly serrated instrument. Now, the only way to get into this angle is if, forgive me, if one is bent over and the blade would have to go through the buttocks on the right-hand side. So it would have to penetrate the entire, you can imagine it. You have to penetrate the entirety of the buttocks with such force that it actually grazes against the bone. Now, I'm not just telling you that because that's enormous fun. One thing that it does show is the brutality of war in the medieval period. But for our story, for the purposes of our story, again, all of these things tally with the contemporary accounts of how Richard was dispatched on Bosworth by the forces of Henry Tudor. The fact that his head wounds are at the back of his head indicates that this was a man not wearing a helmet, which is how Jean Molinet describes him. A royal helmet at that age would have metal flaps that reach down past the trapezium. The injury on this injury here that would have gone through his buttocks, again, a soldier at this time, especially a royal one, would have chainmail that covered the flanks to protect for exactly that injury. So this is only an injury that could have been carried out if there was no armor, which corresponds to Richard being stripped naked and slung over the back of the horse into that position. I'm not going to do that position anymore. just for your benefit. Anyway, so by this stage, after 6 months of forensic analysis on these bones, we have a very clear picture that we're going to have to do something very profound with really strong evidence to show that this is not Richard III. But the amazing thing was that genetics came in and really sealed the whole story, really tied up all of the pieces together in what is statistically pretty watertight. And the way that you do this with genetics is and family trees is that there's two particular bits of DNA that we all have. So, but they are very small bits of DNA, and they are the Y chromosome, which is only inherited from fathers to sons, and there's what's known as the mitochondrial genome, which is only inherited from mothers to both sexes of children. Okay. Now, what these do is they give us a sort of pillars of matrilineage and patrilineage, which allow us to correspond with family trees in order to trace genealogy. So what we needed to do with Richard, and this was a project led by Thierry King at the University of Leicester, is identify living descendants of Richard III. Now, he didn't have any children himself, but by that, what you mean is we have to identify people who shared either Y chromosomes with him, so his brother, for example, or mitochondrial DNA. And if we can trace those lineages into the present, we can then compare the DNA of those people with the DNA that was successfully extracted from the bones found in that Leicester car park. Now, I'll do the men first, because this is quite a funny story. So if you do the men, if you look at the Y chromosome of the bones in the car park, and trace it down, use the family tree to trace living descendants, five were identified who like to remain anonymous. They're referred to as Somersets 1, 2, 3, and 4, and 5. And when they had their Y chromosomes sequenced and read and compared to the Y chromosomes of the body in the car park presumed to be Richard III, they were different. They were not the same. Now, that means one of two things. It means either the body in the car park was not Richard III and the family tree is wrong, or it means the family tree is wrong because of what is technically referred to as a cuckolding event. And the cuckolding event in question appears to have occurred somewhere around John of Gaunt. Now, we can't be more accurate than that without digging up the bodies of the royals, of the people of that time, and looking to see where suddenly the relationship between a father and son is broken, and they don't have the same Y chromosomes because someone wasn't entirely honest about fathering. It also means, for all you Republicans out there, that the lineage that leads to the current royal family is not genetically related to Edward III. Buckingham Palace is yet to comment on this. They don't seem particularly perturbed by this new piece of... I mean, actually, it doesn't really make any difference because Henry Tudor claims the throne in battle from Richard. But, you know, come the revolution... anyway, so it's probably not the right audience to say this to, is it? On the maternal side of things, entirely different story. So mitochondrial DNA extracted from the bones in the car park, and then via almost 20 generations, two individuals were identified, a Canadian carpenter called Michael Ibsen and a British woman called Wendy Duldig. And when their mitochondrial DNA was sequenced, Michael Ibsen's was 100% identical to the mitochondrial DNA found in the car park, and Wendy Duldig's differed by one single letter out of 15,000 letters of genetic code, which is also consistent with her being a direct descendant via 15 generations. And so you have this story where, because of DNA in consort with the rest of the archaeological and historical evidence, that the body in the car park was unequivocally, as far as we can say in science, unequivocally identified as the last Plantagenet king, the last English king to die on the battlefield. I once said that line, I once said in a talk in Scotland, I said the last British king to die on a battlefield. And yeah, there was quite a lot of hissing. So the last English king to die on the battlefield. And I tell this story because it's a perfect version of what we're beginning to do more and more now, which is using genetics as a source, as a text, a historical text. But the body would never have been found if it hadn't been for traditional archaeology and traditional history. So I use this example not just to say how powerful it is as a tool, but how it works best when geneticists are working alongside historians. Right. That's my second king. Now, do any of you watch the television program Who Do You Think You Are? Yes, right. So did any of you see the last series, and particularly the first episode of the last series of Who Do You Think You Are, which featured... Oh, sorry, I missed the best joke about that. It was Lester... yes. Yeah. Leicester Council decided that was the best way to commemorate this fallen king and this great scientific triumph. Right, excuse me. All right, so Who Do You Think You Are? You will recall that the first episode of the last series of Who Do You Think You Are, which is a program that I love, was this man who is an actor called Danny Dyer, who's a sort of cockney wide boy. He's not really my cup of tea, I think is the best way to express it. I believe he's currently the landlord at the Queen Vic in EastEnders. Again, saying that in Yorkshire or in Glasgow has little effect, but I know you all watch EastEnders all the time. Anyway, the point was that Danny Dyer's family history, his genealogy, had been done during the course of this hour-long, brilliant hour of TV, and they had got to the end in a dramatic reveal in Westminster Abbey with the genealogist as he unfurled a great big long scroll that had presumably been printed that day. And at the top of this particular family tree, they discovered that Danny Dyer was 22 generations from Edward III. Now, and Danny Dyer is here to celebrate that. Brilliant. All right, so Danny Dyer is 22 generations from Edward III, which is, you know, his reaction was absolutely brilliant and makes some of the best TV of that year. He said the following things. Well, first of all, he dressed up like Edward III, which was generous of him. He said, the first thing he said was, I need to get this in my nut and then move on with my life. You know, I think we all feel like that from time to time. He said, I'm going to treat myself to a massive ruff. Now, I'm not a historian, but I think ruffs are later. I think this is an anachronistic statement. But then he said this thing, which is, my blood is his blood. I can't compute this in my brain. And I was sitting there thinking, well, do you know what? I think I can. I think I can do this. So I worked with some of my colleagues at University College London, and the question became, so if you can demonstrate using genealogy that you're 22 generations from Edward III, well, the question immediately was, well, what is the likelihood, what is the probability that anyone is directly descended from Edward III? And I and a couple of colleagues, we went through a number of different methods for performing this calculation. And we decided to do three different versions of this calculation in order that we would come up with similar results. You know, we try to approach this from a scientific point of view. So the method that we settled on and the method that produced the answer that we're most happy with is that we counted down the generations, the number of descendants that we could count accurately that that Edward III has, not that Danny Dyer has, number of descendants that we can count of Edward III, and then calculate the number of ancestors that anyone born in the 1970s would have, and try and get those two numbers to meet in the middle. And the year that we chose was 1600, because that's a time at which we have accurate data in both directions. So when it comes to Edward III, he was a particularly fecund ruler. So he had 9 children, 5 of which had issue. He was married to Philippa of Hainault, which, have you ever been to Hainault? Doesn't seem like the type of title you'd actually like. Sorry if you're from Hainault. Is anyone from Hainault? Sorry. It's really nice there. And Philippa was... Anyway, so I counted down his family tree, and he had 245 great-great-grandchildren, which is a lot, but certainly within the bounds of possibility, especially if one is royal and privileged, which he certainly was. And then the calculations become a little bit fuzzier, but we worked out with some error bars in that by the year 1600, he had around 20,000 descendants. Again, that is a high number, but it's perfectly within the bounds of reason. Now, at 1600, the English population is about 4.2 million. So you divide those two numbers together and you work out that one in 210 people in 1600 were directly descended from Edward III. So that's about 0.5 of the population can claim direct descent from Edward III. Right? After that, after 1600, things become a bit fuzzy. So then we start working back from 1975, and if we assume a generational time of about 27 years, which is the standard in genetic genealogy, we can work out that approximately anyone born in the 1970s, I'm born in 75, has around 32,000 ancestors in 1600. Now, the actual number will be smaller than that because of what I was talking about earlier about necessary inbreeding, but nevertheless, the question then becomes, what is the probability that of your 32,000 ancestors alive in 1600, that any of them were within the 0.5% of the population who are directly descended from Edward III? Now, I won't go into the stats on this, but I've published it elsewhere, and the answer comes out as... Actually, you have to do it in reverse first. You have to work out the likelihood that your ancestors were not in that 0.5%, and then you take that away from 1. And the answer comes out as the likelihood, the probability that anyone born in the 1970s does not have an ancestor in 1600 that is directly descended from Edward III is 0.00027001. Now, in terms of statistics, we call that significant. And we did this several ways, and the most conservative estimate, it came out at 0.012 zeros, and then a 1, and the biggest was 23. So basically, looking around this room, every single one of you is a direct descendant of Edward III. Not everyone can prove that using paper trails, using certificates, and the way that Danny Dyer did it in Who Do You Think You Are, but it is literally and mathematically and not conceptually true that everyone in this room is between 21 and 24 generations directly descended from Edward III. So well done, all of you. You may now treat yourself to a massive ruff. Right. But we can do better than this because it's genetics. We can do much better than this. And this is my fourth and final king before we get on to some questions. So fourth and final king is Charlemagne the Great. So the first Holy Roman Emperor, the great European conciliator. He was the first person to try and unite the countries of Europe. See how that worked out. But he was Holy Roman Emperor in the 1780s, died in the 870s, and died in 814. Now, when you do family trees, and in things like Who Do You Think You Are, and when you do genetic genealogy or any form of genealogy, the real kudos comes in managing to identify someone of fame or infamy in your family tree. And the reason I include this story is because this fundamentally is not how genetics works. We focus on those individuals because we can say something interesting about them, because they were interesting people from history. And people have done this through the ages. So this is a family, a Dutch family called the Bakker Dirks, who are a living Dutch family. And they have traced their family tree all the way from Charlemagne, top left corner. This family tree actually only goes up to the 1500s, but it continues, and it's viewable online. It continues down to the living Bakker Dirk family today. So they have demonstrated fairly definitively that Charlemagne is on their family tree 40 generations between him and them today. Now, that gives you great kudos. And, that story continues, and it continues with celebrities doing exactly the same thing. Richard Branson last year announced that he had done his family tree and is 40 generations from Charlemagne. Christopher Lee, the great Christopher Lee, the best Dracula. Yeah, the best Dracula, here he is in that Hobbit film. But what a great actor. He was the son of an Italian countess, and they knew their family tree, and indeed he was 39 generations from Charlemagne. And he used to sort of trade off that because it adds to his august, sinister presence. Anyway, I just want you to hold on to these two people for the next few minutes while I do some maths. So let's go back to this slide, which is standardized family tree, eight generations back, 256 people on one person's family tree as you go eight generations back. Right? So if there's four people, there's around about 1,000 individuals on one's family tree if you go eight generations back. Eight generations goes to about the middle of the 19th century, if we use 25 to 27 years as is standard. And if, I don't know, there's 100 people in this room, if you do 100 people, the number comes out as 900,000 people on all of your family trees if you go eight generations back. Now, very soon, this number becomes obviously impossible, right? Everyone has two parents. That is a biological fact that hasn't been contravened ever. Jesus? No. Anyway, so if you take an individual, one person's family tree, and double the number of ancestors they have every generation, you go back to approximately the 10th century, the number of ancestors on one person's family tree comes out as about 1 trillion. Right? Now, there haven't been a trillion people. The best estimates are that there's been about 107 billion people on Earth, depending on how you count it. But we're several orders of magnitude out for one person's family tree. Now, that has to be correct in terms of straight biology, because all people have two parents. But there are now more living people alive today than there have ever been in history. Right? So what that means, sorry, let me rephrase that. There are more people living today than there have been at any point in history. So what that means is, if we're going to go back to the 10th century, you need to squeeze all of those people in your family tree into the number of people that are alive at that time. And what that means is that many people occupy the same, a lot of people occupy multiple spots on your family tree. It's a form of inbreeding which is very deep and not problematic, and it was in the way that it was for the Habsburgs that I talked about at the beginning. But it has to be that way, because you can't keep doubling the number of the number of people on your generational timeline as you go back through history. Now, what geneticists are interested in evolutionary biology, not just talking about humans, is a concept called the most recent common ancestor, the MRCA. And the most recent common ancestor, I mean, it's a very easy concept. So if you look at a family tree, these two people are first cousins, because their most recent common ancestor is one grandparent. So the most recent common ancestor of two first cousins is a grandparent. In evolutionary and population genetics, what we're interested in is slightly a bigger picture. But this is important, because on each of these individuals' family trees, there are 256 people. But that doesn't mean that there are 512 people on their combined family trees, because everyone above the grandparent is the same person for both of them. Right, so that's the most recent common ancestor. That massively reduces the number of people on both their combined family trees. Now, if we look for the most recent common ancestor for example, for which we've done the best studies, for the entirety of Europe, yes, every European, broadly all people with pale skin of recent non-African descent, then the most recent common ancestor of all Europeans comes out as the 14th century. Right? So if we could draw a family tree, a complete family tree for everyone in this room, there would be one line of all of our family trees that would cross through one individual person, probably in Germany, in around the year that Edward II was king, which I think is stunning. I think that's remarkably recent. And depending on the knowledge of the audience, some people, when I ask that question, some people just go, was it about 1400? And they go, well, yes, you meant to say it's about 10,000 years ago, but it is just 1400. So, but we can do even better than that as well, because family trees become matted and webbed the further back in time that you go. So there's 1400. The concept that we're interested in genetics is called the isopoint. Now, this is quite a tricky concept, and so I'll try and explain it several times. But because we think of family trees as branching outwards, but actually they collapse in on each other, and branches flow through individuals multiple times through history, and there are more people alive now than there ever have been at any point in history, there is a point in time where all branches of all family trees flow through all individuals at that time, And we call that the isopoint. So the other way of describing it is, at the isopoint, if you were alive at the time of the genetic isopoint and you have living descendants today, then you are the ancestor of everyone today.
right? Got that? Right. When we calculate the genetic isopoint for the people of Europe, which was first done mathematically in 2001, and then that result was capitulated in 2012 using genetics, the number comes out as the 10th century, right? So if you were alive in the 10th century and you have descendants who are alive today, then you were the ancestor of literally every European alive today, literally every European. Not conceptually, or literally everyone alive today. We think that around about 70% of people alive in the 10th century have living descendants today. The other 30%, their family, they either didn't have children themselves, or at some point in their generational history, that line died out. But most people alive in the 10th century in Europe have living descendants today, and they are the ancestors of literally everyone today. Okay? Now, just cast your mind back to thinking about Christopher Lee and Richard Branson and Charlemagne. Charlemagne was alive in the 8th and 9th century, which is before the genetic isopoint. You know where I'm going with this, don't you? What that means is that not everyone can prove it using the paper trail, using the family tree like the Back of Dirks did, but literally every person in Europe is directly descended from Charlemagne. And literally, not metaphorically, probably looking around this audience, probably around about 40 to 42 generations. And it's not metaphorical. You have a direct lineage which leads to Charlemagne, to Edward III, and also literally everyone else who was alive in the 10th century. So there you go. I'm going to finish with that so that we can have some questions. But, you know, good for Danny Dyer. Maybe you should all treat yourselves to a massive rough. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.